From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Scott Morrison has his sights set on a shake-up of the Federal Public Service, with a focus on making it more efficient at implementing the government's programs. A review of the service set up by Malcolm Turnbull and headed by businessman David Thodey is now finished. Meanwhile, a study of the public service commissioned by the Australia and New Zealand School of Government has been released this week. It's called Today's Problems, Yesterday's Toolkit, and builds on interviews with nearly 400 public servants in the two countries, but mostly in Australia. This report argues that rising government aversion to innovation and risk-taking is producing a creeping crisis for the public service. Today we have with us the report's authors, Beth Novak and Rod Glover. Professor Novak is a director of the Governance Lab at New York University and ran President Obama's Open Government Initiative. She currently advises Angela Merkel on the digital transformation of society. Professor Glover is interim director at the Monash Sustainable Development Institute. He was a senior Victorian public servant and also was an advisor to Kevin Rudd. Beth, can we start by getting you to tell us something of the background of this study?
So in Australia, as elsewhere, we see a dramatic loss of trust in government and perhaps more worryingly also in democracy. 41% of people say they have faith in democracy in Australia, 31% trust the federal government. That number is even lower for politicians at 21%. In the states where I'm from, that number is 17%. And for Congress, it's as low as we've ever been able to measure, under 10%. That number is actually declining. So it's against that backdrop that we undertook this study to look at what we can actually do to potentially remedy that problem and to come up with specific and concrete responses to actually make government work better for people. And that's why we focused on both the individual skill level and practice level and what people are doing in government and how we can improve those skills, and at the institutional environment, the cultural environment, to facilitate people's use of new and innovative skills that can make them more effective problem solvers.
Now, you say that governments are not doing well at solving public problems and that public servants are being asked to solve today's problems with yesterday's toolkit. Can you give some examples of the failures and also explain the current toolkit and what would a fit-for-purpose toolkit look like?
Absolutely. So let me say right at the outset that the public service in Australia, as in the United States, is highly competent. There are countless governments and people who envy the kind of public sector we have here in Australia and New Zealand, or even back home. We're doing, on the whole, a very capable and competent job. But the challenges that we're facing are serious and getting more complex. We're failing to meet our Paris climate targets, and we know the consequences for the planet of failing to do so. We have rampant problems of inequality. If you look at Australia's, for example, Indigenous incarceration rates, or the widening gaps in terms of outcomes, both in terms of health and wellness and education for different social groups, these are serious challenges that we're not doing a good enough job of meeting.
But one could argue, surely, that that's the fault of governments, not of bureaucracies.
So you are right that we have to draw the distinction between politicians and public servants. But I think it's very important to recognize that regardless of the choice of policies, whether one is left or right or in the center or somewhere altogether different, the way that we make policy, the way that we deliver services can be improved, both in terms of the effectiveness and in terms of the legitimacy of the way that we do things that can serve potentially as a response to that rampant crisis of trust.
And on the toolkit, what is it now? What should it be?
Right. So one of the things we've done in this report is to look at not only what levels of innovative skills are currently among public servants in Australia, but we're looking globally, and that's why coming from the States and as somebody who works with governments around the world, together with Rod, we've been looking at what the most effective governments are doing around the world to actually improve how people work in order to do that better job. So those skills really look like a range of skills that both include better uses of data, include also, and perhaps more surprisingly, better uses of collaboration and participation that tap the intelligence and the expertise of those very people we're trying to help, not only in helping us to define the problems, but also to develop new solutions. And it's not one method by itself. So we look at a range of things from the use of behavioral insights to the use of evidence-based thinking to new uses of data analysis and the way that technologies are enabling these skills. But no one method by itself is actually sufficient. What it is the ability to combine these methods into the agile and rapid ability to efficiently solve problems, to really achieve an outcome and to accomplish a goal.
Now, Rod, let me bring you in here. You've had experience of the service at both federal and state level. You were an advisor to Kevin Rudd when he was Prime Minister. Has the public service, especially the federal public service, become more ineffective over time? Was there some golden age?
Well, I started my career in the federal public service in the Commonwealth Treasury a bit over 20 years ago. And that was a time when Treasury was a hotbed of contested ideas. It was starting in the public service, you would go in and you would have really meaningful debates with people with quite different philosophical views to yourself that were deep intellectual and policy debates that really mattered on the big questions that affect the future of the economy and the future of the country. Around that same time, I would argue that two things shifted. One was in the Commonwealth public sector, for a period we had what was called the 54-11 rule, which encouraged the early retirement of senior public servants. And I think at that point in time, we actually lost, I know in Treasury, we lost a lot of corporate memory. People that still had a lot to actually give to the policymaking process that were pushed out of the public sector due to the rules. Around the same time, governments started to pull back quite significantly on the core policy capability expectations of government departments. And I think those things together have over time meant that it's not that the public sector itself has simply become more ineffective. That has coincided with complex challenges getting more complex, media and scrutiny on politicians and public servants being greater, lesser ability to tailor solutions to local circumstances, and also just the imperative, the realisation to solve really hard policy problems, the public sector actually has to get out of its own shell. So it has to start to engage with business in a different way, engage with civil society in a different way, and talk to the community and talk to the citizens in different ways. And I think all of these forces have added up to a public sector that now does struggle more than it did in the past to tackle the really big challenges of our time.
Well, this fits in with what Scott Morrison's been saying about the public servant's advisory role. At least it's very contrary to what Scott Morrison's been saying. He is stressing the public service delivering programs, and he essentially says the advisory role of the service should be to government on how to implement government's agenda, not to have a more freelancing advisory role. You're presenting a very different picture. What do you think of the Morrison blueprint?
So I think there are actually two sides of it. I think there's an aspect of the Morrison blueprint, as he describes it, that is actually about a better connection with the experiences and services that people experience every day. I think that if that agenda translates into a closer relationship with communities and citizens and a more responsive political system and public service to their needs, I think that's actually a contribution. Where I would disagree is even if the role of the public service in the Prime Minister's mind is merely to respond to the government agenda of the day, the ability of the public service to provide good advice in that space demands that it has a core policy capability, that it understands the problems of the system that it's got to deal with, and it understands where that problem lives in, not just in government, but actually in community and society more broadly. So that there's no shortcut to getting good advice from the public sector, even on implementation of your own initiatives. The public sector needs to be confident, be capable about that underlying public policy advice capability, and be confident that it's not going to be stripped out from time to time at the whim of government.
Your report's looking to a service that's more innovative and risk-taking, but how does that fit with today's public service theory or government theory that the politicians want the public service to be above all responsive to its political masters?
Well, for the government to deliver services or policies that are more informed, more effective and more legitimate in the eyes of the community, that responsiveness can actually line up very well with a government that engages with the community and engages with citizens more. I don't think there's actually an inconsistency there. I think what is different is the realisation that the public sector is part of that larger community conversation. It's not something, it has a body of expertise, deep expertise, the deepest expertise in many of the issues that we confront as a country. So to not be drawing on that expertise as part of that wider conversational democracy, if you like, I think is a waste of that expertise. And it's an expertise that government ministers of either stripe can use as a tool that supports them in their doing their job more effectively as well.
Now, Beth, the report highlights the widening skills gap between the private sector and the public sector. What can be done about this?
The point we're trying to make is that the private sector invests in training, invests in talent building, invests in also the mobility of talent and ensuring that there's a diversity of ideas and approaches. And that's something we need to do more of in the public sector. So we very specifically call here for more training in some of these new skills enabled by technology, as some of the more innovative governments are doing around the world, or just starting to do, really. So just this year, Canada has developed a training program for 150,000 public servants to begin to introduce them to the basics of digital technology, of digital, of data, of AI, of machine learning. In Argentina, they have a training program for 20,000 public servants to introduce them to the idea that you need to actually talk to citizens, to use human-centered design when developing solutions to problems. And now they've started introducing data analytical thinking, better uses of data, to those public servants to help them combine both the qualitative and the quantitative. Those are things, again, that the private sector has been learning how to do, and then I think in many places we're beginning to do in the public sector, and that we think we need to do more of.
Of course, this takes money, and what we've seen in recent years is government, both stripes of government, taking money out of the public service in efficiency, dividends, and so on. Has this been quite destructive to skills?
Well, I think that the, you know, efficiency dividends, which are quite appealing to people, obviously, who doesn't like cost savings, right? But they're a very blunt instrument, in fact, for achieving the kind of outcomes and responsiveness that are being talked about at the same time. Some investment in training, which essentially doesn't have to be that expensive. What's exciting about what some of these new training programs are doing around the world is they're leveraging those self-same technologies that are teaching people about to deliver that training inexpensively and cheaply. So what Canada does is record a 15-minute podcast, not unlike this one, that they call the bus ride, because people can listen to it on their commute. Of course, they encourage public transportation, so they call it the bus ride and not the car ride, that you listen to on your way to work. But for one recording, they can reach 150,000 people with the same podcast. So many people are leveraging new technology to bring down the cost of that skill building. And again, some investment, obviously, in building innovative skills in the long run helps to build cost savings as well as more effective outcomes.
One thing we have seen a lot and increasingly is contracting out of public service programs and even seeking of advice. What effect do you think that's had on the Australian public service?
So I think globally we've seen this phenomenon for many, many years of saying we're going to let the private sector do it instead of the public sector. That's been the legacy of course, the Reagan and the Thatcher years, has been a systematic dismantling of public sector capacity across the board. I'm very familiar with this in the United States, and it's going on now at an ever more rapid pace even than it has done previously. I think, though, that this is really a false economy. There is much good, obviously, to come from consultants and outside perspectives, but we cannot abdicate the public mission and public purpose that only the government and that the public sector can wield, first of all. And that second of all, the convening ability, if central to the view of how we need to practice innovation, is by doing more in terms of collaboration, more in terms of convening people across sectors, more in terms of having those conversations between public and private sector, sharing data between public and private sector and universities and the social sector as well, government is in the best position place to really organize that collective intelligence in a way that nobody else can do.
This study relies on a very extensive direct database, interviews with some 400 almost public servants, federal and state in Australia, most of them, of course, in Australia. How frustrated are these public servants with their political masters and also with their own leaders in the service?
So I think we found two things, one definitely frustrating and pessimistic and the other optimistic. The frustrating thing that we found is that 40% of people said that their senior managers are not willing to take risks, that they don't support innovation, that they would like to be more innovative, but they feel constrained in doing so. So we did do the work of both asking individuals about their own skills, but also asking about the cultural and environment and institutions in which they exist. And that's where we saw a lot of negativity in terms of people feeling constrained. On the other hand, the positive story is that people want to do better and want to do more. So they want to learn. When we ask them about these innovative skills in terms of uses of data or open innovation or behavioral insights, people wanted to learn more about these skills. Everybody told us they want more and they want it in new ways and they want to learn it differently online. They want to get coaching to help them take their own projects from idea to implementation. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for new ways of working, but also at the same time some pessimism about their ability to put these ideas into practice. So we saw a big gap between awareness of innovative skills and the actual use of them for this reason.
And they were blaming those further up the chain for this gap?
Yes. So we saw blame of both middle management and of senior management. So people pointing the fingers one at the other in terms of where that blame lies.
Rod, the loss of public trust is something that obviously is at the centre of this report. How can a reformed public service, though, help repair what is a much wider problem for the political system?
I think it's important to see the breakdown in trust as part of what is a vicious cycle. And that vicious cycle is the limited capability of the public service and other actors to come together and deliberate on difficult public problems, leading to a lack of progress on those public problems, which in turn is undermining the trust and the perceived legitimacy in the eyes of the public. So I think in terms of that capability, effectiveness, trust cycle, the capabilities of the public sector are an obvious entry point. They're something that we can influence. They're something that with better training and better support, we can actually make a difference. So I think that where it really matters is it's not so much the capabilities of the public service for the sake of it. It's the capabilities of the public service to engage with others so that we deliver more effective outcomes for the community. And that's really the only basis on which we're really going to rebuild trust and legitimacies in the eyes of the public.
Now, we're about to get the Thodey report, the official report on the federal public service. Have you had any input into that report?
We've got a conversation with the APS review panel team this afternoon, but certainly we've been monitoring that along the way and talking to individuals involved in that process along the way.
And we're also going to get in a week or so a major speech from the Prime Minister about the public service. Rod, if you were advising Scott Morrison about his desire for an improved public service, what would you say to him?
I'd say that a capable and confident public service can help him achieve his goals, but more importantly, can help him work with others to achieve the goals that the community expects of government. I'd say that a capable and confident public service is not something to be scared of. It's something that can help any government implement whatever agenda it has of the day, but also something that is essential in the long run to the effective functioning of our democracy and the rebuilding of trust and legitimacy in the eyes of the public.
We've had so many reports on the public service or on specific issues within the public service over the last decade and more. Do you think that we really are going to get any sort of meaningful change at this point? Or do you think everyone says, well, there are a lot of problems, there are a lot of potential solutions, but really nothing alters?
So I think a lot does depend on the stance of the Thodey Review. I think there are a lot of people in the public service that are hoping that the Thodey Review stands up for what the public service could be as it looks forward. I think that there are aspects of that agenda that actually align very neatly with where the Prime Minister might want to take things. So, for instance, if the 30 report was to recommend a greater focus on public outcomes, not simply agency outcomes or narrower responsibilities, I think people across the political divide would say that's a good thing. If the Prime Minister wants to do congestion busting within the public sector and take out some of those limitations on new methods being used in the public sector, I think a lot of public servants would say that's a fantastic thing. And I think if the government embraced the public sector's ability to talk to communities, to talk to citizens more, to be more responsive to their needs, but also to talk to a wider range of stakeholders about how collectively we're going to solve our hard public problems, then again, I think that's something that could actually achieve bipartisan support. So I think there's actually more opportunity for an agenda that can be supported across the political aisles than is being recognised just at the moment in the debate.
Well, thank you both for coming in. Your report is both interesting and incredibly timely, as it turns out. And I think that we're going to hear a lot about the public sector in the weeks and months to come. That's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Rashna Farooq, and we'll be back with another interview soon. But goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.